Okay, the topic is hope in politics and business. And I don't know if you put et cetera on the board or not, but we want to, really would like to get everybody involved. If you've been to my sessions before, you find out I don't like to talk too much, just a little bit, and then sit back and listen, because I would like to learn some things in this session. I thought this could be a sharing session where we could each talk about examples of things that we've seen or been involved in or read about, or ideas that you've thought about that haven't been put into practice, that would express hope, whatever hope is, as we've demonstrated today or read about today, and not just necessarily apply it to politics and business. I guess the reason we stuck that name on it is because I'm involved in business, and Larry is in business and in government both, and I've just gotten out of government a little bit, so we have a kind of a common thread running through our thinking of things that we've seen that we think are hopeful. But I hope that all of you, regardless of what your background is, art and theology and all those other things, could enter in some of the things that you see in your field or see in our fields that you think are hopeful. One of the things I'd like to do is just to give examples of hope and not necessarily critique them. One of the things that could happen is I could give one example and we could talk about why that's not a good example or how it might not work somewhere else, or, you know, get drifting off into all kinds of problems with that. I hope we don't get into that this afternoon. Rather, that we talk about demonstrations of things that are, or ideas of things that express hope in the daily social activities that we get into, or the social institutions as well as business and government. That's awfully loose, and that's good. We can wander around in that, I think, for quite a while, probably for many hours. I thought I'd just kick it off with one idea that I've been involved with 3 years that I really think gives me a lot of hope. Personally, every time I get involved in this thing, which is about once a week, I come away with a lot of hope and I feel very good. And it's a daycare center. Daycare centers are lots of fun to get involved in. I recommend that for everybody, particularly men, because men don't get exposed to large numbers of kids like that as much as women do, I think. That may be a stereotype that's not too good anymore. But at least I've noticed that the men that work in the center, just work with the center, get an awful lot out of it. But the particular center I have in mind is even a lot more hopeful because it's financed somewhat, to some extent, by industry, and industry uses it as a means of solving social problems and their own problems as well. Some of you have heard me talk about it before. It's a center up in North Minneapolis. It's targeted at hiring primarily women on welfare. It's purposely aimed in that direction. In fact, the 8 companies that run the center will only children can be in the center whose parents are working for one of those 8 companies. Now, the 8 companies are very large firms. Most of them are nationally known firms. We're thinking about this as something we do all over the country, and we're expanding in the Minneapolis area. The idea works something like one of the large companies in downtown Minneapolis has an opening, a job opening, and it's the kind of job that they could train an AFDC mother to get into. They will meet her up at the daycare center in her community rather than asking her to come downtown. Many times people that live in the inner city have not been downtown. That was an interesting finding that we had. In fact, a large majority of people that live just a mile from downtown Minneapolis have never been downtown, especially the young people. Some of the most interesting experiences is taking an employee who has never been downtown sometime, or out to the airport. I had a secretary up in our plant in North Minneapolis, and one day I said, let's go out to the airport, we've got to pick something up, and then you can drive it back and I'll go home. And I didn't realize she'd never been out of the airport, never even been out in that direction, and she was just absolutely like going to Mars. I had to walk around. It took me 2 hours just to show her everything there was to see at an airport. It was a great experience. But anyway, that whole idea is used to make it comfortable for a woman who has been living up in an area like that to become introduced to the world of work. So the first thing she's interested in, the primary thing she's interested in, is in the kind of care her children will get. And once she feels comfortable with that, And the next thing she'll look at is, what kind of work am I going to be doing? And then they can go from there, leave the child in the center, go downtown, look over the working arrangements, and make the deal. And then every day, she'll bring her child to the center and then go downtown. Transportation is usually arranged for the parents and the children to get to the center or to get downtown or whatever. Now, most of this is funded by the federal government. 3/4 of it is. 1/4 of it's funded by the local firms. It does a lot of good things. There might be some bad things too, but it does an awful lot of good things. First of all, it brings development to the child, and that's hope for the future. And there's a lot of hope there, really lots of hope. Child development of the earlier aged kids from age 3 months up through kindergarten has just got all kinds of potential for reducing the kinds of social problems we have today. And I'm going to talk about that Friday night, but there's a lot of hope there. And that to me is the most important thing. Our school system for some reason starts at grade one at age 6, or kindergarten. And I really feel it should start a lot earlier, and we're beginning to get a system around the country that does start earlier. And secondly, it provides meaningful employment for somebody who really wants to work. And sometimes the motivation for work, lots of times the motivation for work is the child itself. An AFDC mother usually does not have the father around, that's why she's on welfare, has nothing really other to live for other than the child. So it provides her with something to be proud of, for the child to be proud of. That's a very important thing. And it provides the employer with a stable workforce. The workforce in that area and in the 3 other plants we have like that around the country have become one of the most stable workforces that we have anywhere. And they're very productive and easily trainable. We were surprised to find out how well it worked for us. And absenteeism is down and turnover is down because of the daycare center. We've proven that. And it's good for the community, brings in business. It's a $250,000 business a year, brings a lot of cash into the community. And what else? A couple other things, I think. It provides a way for guys like myself to get involved in managing operations that we've not managed before. And it also provides a way of us getting involved in the problems in the inner city. Lots of spin-offs, guys who come into that thing and then have gotten involved in other problems like housing, and they can spurt off from there, because through that kind of thing you can get connected into all kinds of other problems or advantages or challenges within the inner city. Probably the most hopeful thing is that about the daycare center is that all the presidents of all the companies involved have backed the thing from the beginning. But after they visited it this year, we invited each one of them personally to come in and visit it. They really got excited about it, and they really want to push it. And this is the head of the Federal Reserve Bank, and I think it's the whole district. The 8th, 9th? Head of Pillsbury, the head of Control Data, the head of Dayton's department store, Lutheran Brotherhood, one of the big savings and loan associations, and on and on. And there are a lot of companies like International Multifoods, I believe, is coming in with us now. General Mills, I think, is coming in. And they can see all these advantages, and they want to keep pushing them. It's a way that industry can work with the government and the community and around a key subject to make a lot of good things happen. And I guess that the most hopeful thing is that it's working, people see it's working, and they're pushing it. And that's one of the most exciting things I've been involved in outside of my own regular business activities in a long time. So that's something that a lot of people can get involved in. It's easy. Yes, ma'am?
I'm just curious, do you have people available to go to homes when a child is ill so that they can still go?
Yeah, they have and that's a kind of a tough problem. It's not kind of, it is a tough problem. Right now, if the child is ill, we have a special room where the kids go to. But if they're really ill, their parents have to come take them home. Now, there are a few special centers in town where they have, they're called the ill sick centers, where kids go, instead of going to their regular daycare center, they go to this one if they're ill. And it's the one that, one or two of them that we have are connected with the new children's hospital. So if a kid is really sick, he'll kind of slide right into the hospital. The hospital kind of runs it. So if he's sick, and comes to the center and then gets sicker, it's kind of like a children's hospital reaches out and takes a look at him, and if he's really, really sick, they take care of him. But that's not all put together. That's one of our challenges.
A thing that I've seen happen, or is in the process of happening, the American Lutheran Church decided that a lot of more optimistic areas like we are, nothing as much is happening in community development. In other words, one small town is really in competition with another town in every way, and it's very difficult to get them to work together. Like thinking of airports, every little town thinks in point of state government, it's really a problem. Every little town thinks they need an airport, and instead of, you know, three towns or four towns getting together, it's maybe only 10 miles out to a center point where an airport could be put, and you know, you're at the most 10 minutes away from the airport, and you're probably a lot better than that, living in a big city. Well, this particular thing is called SyncoAd, which is an initial for something, and it's hooked into Augustana College in a, just in a way to give it structure, and they went out and found a person with a lot of expertise in many areas, in development of community, and he had a lot of background in rural, small town kind of thing, and they are really doing quite a thing. Just some examples. In my community, we had a real severe hailstorm 3 years ago, so that everything was just like this rug after a huge corn crop was way up here. And, you know, everyone is, if you know anything about the expenditure in agriculture nowadays to develop a crop, pretty well feeling wiped out and not knowing what to do, including the bankers, you know, just sort of stunned. And small towns look ahead after something like that for almost being dried up. And they came in, and they're very low-key. They get people like myself who are willing to make some phone calls and things to get together and started applying pressure and seeking ways for help. And, of course, there is federal, you know, assistant loans and this kind of thing. Even some people who whose financial condition was made extra critical were able to obtain forgiveness loans and this kind of thing. Well, this is one example that they did here about a month ago. The president of the chairman of the Ninth Federal Reserve, called by the name of Bruce McLaren in Minneapolis, which are 12 such circuits or districts in the United States, and he's chairman of one of these districts. It's an extremely influential position in the money market. Decided he wanted, you know, all he ever gets exposed to is bankers on a very large scale. And he decided that he wanted to go around his district and talk to plain old John Doe down there, who was farming or running a store in a little town or whatever. And it's difficult for those kind of people, you know, if they start making contacts through banks, then they end up talking to the same kind of people all the time. And so he got a hold of SyncoAd, and SyncoAd got a group of us, about 8 or 9 of us together. And in bounces this young guy, you know, in my mind I had a guy pictured that would be at least 75 and extremely, you know, white shirt and what all. Here bounces in a guy about 40 or 45 and he's dressed real neat. And was quite nervous, you know. He opened the meeting with yeah, his voice was breaking, and he said, you know, I really don't know how to get started. I'm used to sitting down with the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System, and he said, I'm really kind of shook up today about just how we're going to do this, how we're going to do this. And we just had a great time for a few hours. We told him what life was like for us, and the natural problems, and banks not being big enough anymore to handle funds. And all of this kind of thing. It was just a sign of encouragement that one guy in a very important position said, you know, instead of staying up here in my cocoon and having and being fed all the information that I really want to be fed, I'm going to get out there all by, you know, without somebody cushioning everything and get told off even, you know. I kind of kept pushing him, and finally he turned to me and gave me a little, you know, like this, and said, well, you quit pushing me in a corner, you know. And we kind of had fun about it because, you know, we were pushing too. We saw some areas where maybe he could do some things because of his position. And we just had a real congenial type meeting. Well, this to me says hope. You know, there's a guy in a very key position saying, I care. And this is, you know, that's all this meeting about it. It's a day of hope and different ones of your name in these couple of three areas of politics or government or business have experiences which you see, you know. Nothing more than a brief little story like that, but it gives each other of us hope.
I got a lot of them for pauses like this where you're thinking about it. Can't have too many pauses. Otherwise we'll begin to think there's no hope out there. I was just thinking as you were talking about something Raleigh Larson and I were talking about hope in the number of problems that we have to solve. Last week there was some people got, as you've heard, probably a little bit depressed because we kept talking about all the problems, describing them. We described them in great details at some points. Several people walked away saying, I wish they'd give us some solutions to all these problems. Why do we, you know, why do we just talk about these cynical problems? The point of a lot of these things is just to expose people to the problems so that they can think about it intelligently or more intelligently, as we say, when they read about it in the paper, or maybe even get spurred to get involved somehow. Because there are so many fantastically interesting problems, and I never call them problems myself, I always talk of them as challenges, that do seem to have solutions. The solutions aren't there, necessarily. Most of the problems that I look at personally, that I like to get involved in, don't have solutions yet, but there's some potential ones. And that's what's fun. You can go out there, dig around, and get involved. Lots of the time through the business that you're in, and they're really the challenges that that make life interesting, give you an opportunity to go out and practice a Christian vocation. There are all kinds of them around. I can list hundreds of them. The problem that many of us have is that there are so many of them, we start grabbing at them and end up with far too many and then start wearing yourself out. You can't do that either.
If you see your experience with these firms as strong evidence for more social concern on the part of large corporations, for example?
Yeah, it's coming slowly, and they're not spending any large amount of their resources to it. The structure's built such that they can.
How do they accommodate themselves to the stockholders who essentially are in it to make money, and they're spending their money instead of improving the product, improving the environment? Well, they can argue about in the long run it'll come back, but in the meanwhile my dividend check is lower. Do they have great pressures from this point?
You have more visible pressure, not numerical stock pressure, but visible pressure in stockholders' meetings to do something about it. People that tend to show up to stockholders' meetings, other than the guys that run the company, are people out there shaking the stick saying, do something about social responsibility. And the longer range approach, I think, is beginning to prevail, that unless industry does begin to take some interest in however they do it, in things that are happening socially, environmentally, etc., there may not be much left to do business in after a while. That's a very simplified version of it. That's a 10 to 15 to 20 year outlook. But all the presidents of this consortium that I'm involved in have that view. I know that personally because when we opened the daycare center, I cleared my speech with them all, and that's one of the statements I made. And they said, amen, yes sir, that's true. We really are concerned about our community. That's one of the larger concerns that they seem to have in their corporate concern is, they're thinking way out. That's their job, one of their jobs. What's it going to be like 10 years from now? What am I going to be selling 10 years? But who am I going to be selling to? Where are my customers going to be? Where are my employees coming from? Not just is this urban sprawl going to spread people out all over the map. Many of them are being pulled back into the inner city. We own a large financial company in Baltimore, for instance. Baltimore, inner city, is one of the most miserable places you can possibly imagine. Can't be much worse. And almost all the businessmen had decided that they were going to get out, go out to the suburbs. But somehow they got talked into staying, and they're all there, and all the heads of the big firms down there have a committee they've had for several years to rebuild the downtown of Baltimore. And it's costing them a lot of money. But it would have cost them an awful lot more to move, too. So sometimes you don't have any choice. If you're going to stay in business, you've got to do one or two things. It's going to cost you something. And you have to put out some capital, but in the long run, you know, the solution or decision is made socially, like that one was. That was strictly a move. Well, no, that's economic, too. You know. But if they had abandoned the inner city and left this huge morass of slums around it, I mean, that really is a mess around it, with no way of getting income out of business. They don't get too much of their income out of the businesses anyway. A lot of it's in drug traffic and all kinds of other illegal things. They have their own businesses, but it does have a lot of a stabilizing effect in the city.
We had an experience last year, if I get up into this and it's not relevant, I met a young man and his wife here last year, great time. They were here a week, and then as frequently happens, they leave and you have hangs. I got back home and had discovered that the area close to my home, and actually would have impinged on some of our territory, was about to be taken over by NSP, the Northern States Power Company. It was one of seven favorite spots to put up a new power plant. And a lot of neighbors, a lot of townspeople in Northfield got excited. The relationship between the first part of the story and this is it turned out that the man in charge of environmental concerns, environmental affairs for NSP, was Jolly Raleigh Comstock, who was here at the village last summer. So I got to see a lot of Raleigh because we immediately formed a group to do two things. One, to make sure it wasn't put in our backyard. At the same time, this got to be a real problem because if it's not in my backyard, it's going to be in yours. So we had to incorporate in our interests questions such as, why don't we begin to find out what the state power demands are as opposed to the state power needs? Never heard about needs. We heard about demands, and they had charts to prove it. We were very fortunate in our group, in our area, in being able to solicit excellent professional support from the two colleges in the community who eventually we went to the state meetings and went to NSP's own public meetings. And the state at this time had set up a environmental quality council with some subcommittees that had hearings on the placement of this power plant in the state. And we were fortunate having the support of our own scientists who lived in our community using NSP's own data and running it out further than they had, that we had a glorious self-congratulatory evening where we proved that they couldn't even do what they wanted to do with their own statistics. It wasn't a matter of whether you wanted it, but they couldn't do it. There wasn't enough water, first of all, to plant it. Then the next choice was another site which was filled with farms. And the farmers organized, and they gave a great deal of static and flack when that site was chosen. And after having gone through the area purchasing some of the land, they got such bad press and bad reactions. I guess literally some instances of run off with a shotgun, that they stopped buying land to establish their power plant. Well, the sign of hope here is not that it was stopped particularly, but that all kinds of questions are now raised to the level of state planning commissions to see what you have to give. If you want to put up another power plant, you're going to lose your land. You're going to lose your fresh air. Or can you cut back on the demand of power? So I think the sense of hope that I see is not that it was stopped so much as it was that the questions about
priority in terms of power needs, really we're focused in a whole strata. I live in an area of farmers who have been farmers since the latter part of the 19th century, and a new PhD just came out of Harvard who lives in the farm right next to me. This is the kind of spread that we have in the background of interest, and the cooperation and attempt to try to find answers to the threat to us.
I think it's a sign of hope that guys like Raleigh Comstock are in positions like he is in.
Oh, yeah.
He's a fantastic Christian guy. Yeah, he really is. And he sounds like he might be an engineer. He's a lawyer by trade, and made his career with NSP by working out deals like this for power lines, mostly, you know, trying to figure out how to sneak power lines through all these areas, crowded areas. And he's just an expert at going and dealing with people. I'm sure he's been run off of more farms with shotguns than anyone else we know, but he's a very gentle, pleasant guy. And in fact, he works with the brokerings in their house church. Yes. I think that he and the brokerings really run it and keep it going. In addition to that, he's a poet to some extent. I mean, he does poetry with film. He likes to take pictures, and he and her brokering put things together. Someday they'll probably publish something. So he's got that kind of sensitivity to him. He was just recently promoted to the assistant to the president. And his assistant too. It's a very, very important job, where he now is involved, I believe, in the long-range planning stuff you're talking about. They've been burned so many times, and they know the state isn't going to do it, but they're going to try to do something like the state ought to be doing.
They were very much behind all citizen groups who were trying to get the state to set up regulatory agencies. They said, we can't do it. We got the law, so we can go out and I can take your land. I have a right because of a quasi public utility of taking your land, paying you a price, but you cannot refuse it. But we don't want to do it that way. I think it's immoral. So we want state regulatory agencies to get involved. NSP pushed very hard, and eventually, well, there is now the beginning of it.
You just hired a man from Washington to come and handle your concern.
To handle it?
Yeah, Jock Robertson. Worked at the University of Minnesota and the state as county director. Set up system. The state of Washington is starting, in fact, the gentleman will be up here this coming week. He's the planning director for the state, and they're trying to set up laws to do that.
Raleigh's idea is to go one step further. He'd like to leap over this state thing and go into the regional.
The regional, yeah.
The power obviously doesn't stop at the border.
Like the regional crime commissions, they've been able to regionalize that. I don't know how much good they do, but at least they've got a thing.
Yeah. Meanwhile, they're still building that plant, or want to, so I don't want to be too hopeful.
Well, it's hopeful that there are so many people there are a lot of guys like Raleigh in businesses. It's amazing. I don't know why I should say that it's amazing. I do, though. I guess I still have a childhood stereotype of businessmen as being big, bad Wall Street bankers or something like that. There's a new organization called the Involvement Corps. It's one like many that have been set up, but this one's working. It came out of San Francisco, and it's moving into many major cities, and Minneapolis is the area I'm aware of, where eight or nine of the larger companies have asked them to come in and help them find ways for their employees to get involved in something in a very meaningful way. And they've been able to crack that problem. That's a hard problem to crack. The big thing now with companies, apparently, is to find employees that want to do something. And many, many, many come and say, what can I do? You know, can't you figure out something I can do outside my job? You'd be just amazed at the requests. Hundreds and hundreds of them. And so that's a problem. You really got a problem if you're a businessman. And if you say you're socially responsible. Well, this outfit will come in, find different kinds of projects that are going on around town or are getting going, and arrange associations between your employees and those projects, aside from the business, got nothing to do with the business at all, to help lend their expertise to them, like a drug center. I think maybe one that will go is a drug treatment center that already exists. And the people that want to get involved, there may be 15 guys that have all kinds of backgrounds, finance, personnel, you know, and all that kind of stuff, who can somehow help that place get better. You know, maybe it's just plain bookkeeping. Somebody I can help with the bookkeeping. one of the things they guard against is letting middle-class whites from the suburbs come in and take over. That's the real problem, because they tend to kind of worm their way in, and pretty soon they're running the whole thing, and pretty soon it dissolves. That's the track. They've discovered a way of preventing that from happening. It's a very complex way. The encouraging thing is that there are a lot of people who, I think, sincerely want to get involved and have.
Why don't you talk on the other half of your topic for a minute? It might take only 3 minutes.
Government?
Yeah, open policy.
Why have we been avoiding that? Or just
the fact that you're in it, is that a hope for us?
I have one thing to say. I'm encouraged by the caliber of people that are in government, like Larry. I ran into many, many men like Larry. I spent half my time lobbying in the Minnesota legislature this year, and you read the newspaper and you see all these bad stereotypes. These guys are really bad. You know, and you get to meet them and work with them, and you find out that they really aren't that bad. And you find out the newspapers have a tendency to take something that might be just a little tiny shaded gray, and they'll paint it black. So you don't get a very good look at these fellows, and they work awfully hard, and are generally great people. That encouraged me. There's a lot of hope there. And they're the kind of people that can make things work, and they seem to be heading in the right direction. I thought I'd come out of dealing with the legislature being depressed, and I came out absolutely refreshed, one of the best experiences I've ever had.
We're going to have to get involved more in the federal legislature.
I would relate that, and of course, we come from a very small state in America, South Dakota, but my constituents are saying to me loud and clear, I'm talking about percentages now, not everybody, but a very high percentage is saying to me, we're sick and tired of the Republican and Democrat thing as being the big thing. You know, go down there and, you know, go out to here and do your thing the best way you know how. And they're really saying it loud and clear, in spite of all the hubbub around election time. I happen to be a Republican, and that is no big deal with me. I really couldn't care less. I just don't know of any other way to try to influence or than to work through the system. So I volunteered to be a committee man in the precinct, and then somebody noticed that kind of went pretty good, so I became county chairman, and then made the move into actually running for office. And I think, you know, that I'm not suggesting in any way that we do away with the party system, because I don't know how to replace it. But I really am encouraged by the fact that people are saying, you know, go down and do your best job. And I find more and more people are voting for the better candidate, you know, what they think is the better candidate. Now, you know, we get into that hassle, but it's very difficult for a candidate to really present himself to the people, because of just getting around everybody, but and TV makes it all the worse.
Question, are you in the state legislature?
Yes.
Do you find people are more informed about what is in their best interest, or what you might consider in their best interest, when they vote for state legislatures as opposed to their congressmen or senators?
Oh, I think so. I think the state legislature affects your life so much more than the national does. So much of that is so remote.
So they're more likely to respond to results and things like this in the state, and more to personality in the national. You think, is that a fair statement?
Say that again.
They'd be more likely to respond to results, to be able to determine whether you're doing a good job and vote, as opposed to the national, which is more personality. They like the guys.
I'll have to admit that when it comes to national, I still tend to vote more according to the ideology of the party and what their platform is saying. Because, I don't know how else to, how do you really know about two guys running for president? You just never, but the most you ever do is wave your hand at them 100 yards away.
I think people respond personality in national.
Right. With me, when I walk down the street, I have 14 small towns in the rural area that's around it. They can get a hold of me pretty easily, and they do.
That might be the hope. That's just this kind of accountability. which is obviously the problem that we've had in Washington for so long, that you just can't get anybody to ask them that question.
It's not too, I don't know how difficult it is to get a hold of your state senator or representative, but they, if you, has anyone tried that here?
I really don't think it's as difficult as people seem to think.
I don't have trouble, but I think it's because I come from a big corporation and I'm always representing their interests. But if I came representing myself, they might throw me out. I don't know.
In the state of Washington, I happen to be an architect in the American Institute of Architects and Consulting Engineers Council every year has a two-day seminar in Washington, D.C. And representatives from each state visit with their particular representatives and senators. And I know that there were things last year that we called Jackson and Magnuson, and we get a hold of them, talk to them on the phone. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of putting in the call.
I remember one time I went to Washington, I brought my 10-year-old daughter along on a business trip, and after I got done, I took her around. And we visited several offices of congressmen, and they were more interested in seeing me because I had a young kid with me than otherwise. They came out and met her, and one of them took her on a tour of the building, you know. So he really was accessible. I shouldn't have said that. I've forgotten about that trip. And I don't know if he was looking for her.
That might not be good.
What?
You weren't the one that was popular.
No, it was her. See, she's a future voter.
Future voter.
Oh, wow.
We had a lot easier time, I think, getting hold of the representative, say, than we do the senators. Of course, our senators from Washington are fairly busy guys because they both have a lot of seniority.
But they have good staffs, and they'll talk
yes,
to you.
They do.
And they're really, you can call them up almost any time and get a hold of them. That's encouraging. I found them not only to listen, but they get things done. Like this recent welfare crisis that everybody seemed to be getting, has gotten involved in one way or another. That was really encouraging because the public at large, it looked like, from all over the United States just swelled up and said, that's a crazy idea you're trying, and they backed off, and they didn't do it. And they said, we'll go back and think it through and try it again. And I didn't think that would happen, but it did, and it was one of the most encouraging things I've ever seen in government.
Yeah, I come to think about it, and Mark Hatfield is this kind of guy, in a sense accessible, and evidently he will listen. He's not not around Oregon a whole lot, and there was real question about his success in Oregon. Suggested to one of his aides, could he be around the state for, 4 or 5 days and just have some listening centers around? I got two letters from him, I got three phone calls from his manager, and one from him, and all with this one idea. And of course, that had to do with winning an election, but it also had to do with his accessibility.
He listened to you.
He was willing, at least, to do that. I think.
Jason Flies is raising your hand.
In the area of influence on your legislators, if you are, involved in a farm organization or insurance field or banking or anything. Find out who your local man is and just simply become his friend. It isn't a matter of, we're so terribly busy during the session that when somebody comes rushing up to my seat and says, you got to vote this way because I want it. Right away, if you know about body language, you tend to, go the other way just a little bit. And the fact of the matter is, you're probably not going to give that person much time because it's just a matter of you're only human, you can only go so many hours a day. And the guy that is a friend, and calls you up on the phone or sets it up just in some other way, and you have lunch together, just like to visit with you and simply explain the problem. It's a matter of education, just like with anything else. We have to vote and be experts in 1,000 fields. We handle more legislation in 9 weeks in South Dakota than Congress does in a year. Well, obviously, you're going to vote stupid. A should say uninformed.
But you see a tremendous amount of legislation coming through, and I've seen it coming here in Washington. These guys just have no way.
No way of doing research, you know. And I'm on Appropriations Committee, which is so terrible. It's five times as busy as any other committee. And we meet every day, all forenoon, have session in the afternoon, and then meet at night again. And then we try to get other meetings. And it's like I told someone the other day, and they were quite shocked. I quite often go and vote cold, you know. And about all I can do is just get a hold of somebody. This is toward the end of the session when it's really tough. You know, count people that you count on in different areas, and say, you know, well, how is this going to affect me? There'll be people that'll say, well, I'm going to vote this way, but knowing you and your constituency, you would represent them better this, or, you know, they'll better with me.
But what makes that happen? That seems to me, you know, monumentally irresponsible to do that.
To do
to vote uninformed as a legislature.
Well, you have people that I think put in legislation as a means of keeping their name in the paper. Plus, the constituency demands a lot of things. You know, they say, here's a problem, won't you do anything, something about it? So they put in a piece of legislation. Now, this last year, I put in one bill that was just initiated by me. I was on some others that people asked me to be on, and I was willing to be on. But we had a freshman legislator, a gal come in, put in 39 bills.
Well, what I guess I don't understand the operation. Why doesn't the legislature, in its operation stuff, have some way of stiffarming that so that, you know, so that people at least have time to be informed?
We've studied it and studied it and can figure out no ways to constitutionally deprive a legislator from introducing legislation.
Yeah, but it's off the point, I guess, here.
But let you know,
kind of law in the committees too.
That would be a way to
but
it comes out with a new pass.
Right, and that's where it gets weeded down a great deal. But nevertheless, these committees are overworked. Everybody.
But when you said you voted cold, you said you also asked for advice.
When I say that, Mary, I mean I have not had time to personally visit the committees.
Right.
To sit in. This is where you really learn in legislature is to visit a committee. That's where the pros and cons and the lobbyists can all speak.
Yeah.
And everybody, the citizens, anybody can come in and have their say.
Yeah.
Once it's on the floor, then only the legislators, and they're not, you know, there's no way we can be informed.
There's no way a legislator can do that at all. Just no timing way. Doesn't work out right. He has to depend on lobbyists and the committee.
That's right. I think, you know, your point of being irresponsible, I think it sounds irresponsible, but I think that if the person... I think it's just because he happens to be fairly honest, this particular guy. He says that he is completely cold on it. It also means that he was asked, you know, he might have asked advice on how to go about it.
Yeah, I didn't mean he
worked. No,
I meant a legislature that operates that way is operating irresponsibly vis-a-vis its
constituents. So you mean on the whole structure?
Yeah.
The way
because they shouldn't do that.
Well, it gets back to the fact that the citizenry will not put up with very much salary for legislators.
And so
if you try to introduce a bill for a little higher annual salary, they just boom, you know, and hits all the papers and everything. So everything gets restricted, you know. How much of your time can you put in for that little salary? 9 weeks is...
I felt there was a great deal of hope that anything got passed through the legislature at all. It came out one end after watching that system work. Not sure it is, but Minnesota is, and I think they all operate the same. I was just amazed that they came out as well as they did. I was telling Larry some stories the other day. I was staffing a bill through, and it got lost three times in the process. Some secretary would stick it in the desk on a Friday night and forgot to put it in there, not move it on to the next committee, and then they'd be looking around for it a couple days later. And if I hadn't been following it along and rummaged through some desks, the thing would never have gotten around. There's ways of solving that. they've been recommended. But it really is an intricate process.
And the intricacy is your protection.
Yes.
You know, with all the complicated, you know, every committee on each house has to study it, and each house analyzes it, and still gross mistakes can be made, you know. So when people say to me, you know, why don't you really simplify it and don't spend so much time on it, I just throw up my hands because that's, it's in all that complicated procedure that they get weeded out. And, some funny things happen, people will put in a bill. A good friend of mine put in a bill for a guy back home last year that would make it so that people with extreme physical disabilities would not have to pay property tax. Property tax is off the book, pays just about the whole bill. It's immoral, you know. And so he put the bill in thinking that this was a great thing. The bill came up in committee, and everybody around the table said, heck, I know a guy that lost a leg in an accident and he got $500,000. Another guy said, yeah, I know a guy that got hurt and was awarded $750,000. And everybody started saying, well, you know, they're really not hurting that bad, you know. And still there can be individuals that really are hurting. But when you start passing legislation, you get yourself dealing with generalities that and the thing just, you know, exploded for him. And in fact, he said, no, check it. And this is the kind of thing that happens. You get into areas that you had no chance to think through, and thinking through wouldn't be enough because you have to.
We were also talking about some foreign things. I don't know how close they come to government or business. In our business right now, we're dealing with the Russians and other Eastern Bloc countries. And it's been encouraging and hopeful to watch how that's gone, at least in not some, I don't know, in terms of business, but in terms of the kinds of relationships that seem to be developing. They're very friendly. And they visited three or four computer companies, the top guys in this field, to try to decide who to contract with and how much. And they visited a couple Eastern companies, countries. And they really got wined and dined. They took them out to the greatest places in New York to eat, and they showed them the best shows. By the time they got to Minnesota, we didn't know what the heck to do with them. So one of our guys owned a farm south of town, and they decided to take him out and show him a typical old country farm. And all of a sudden it dawned on us after we got out there that these fellows were all sons of peasants. They're just one generation removed from the soil. They got out on that farm and they just reveled in it. And they didn't want to leave, and they got around the kitchen table and drinking coffee, and they were ready to make the deal right there. And when they left, we were trying to figure out what kind of a gift to give them. We went out and got an old pipe stone peace pipe and gave it to them with a little plaque. We were kind of worried if that, you know, would have political connotations or what, but we gave it to them, told the interpreter what it was all about, and they were just absolutely delighted. And they took it back to Russia. When they got back there, got all the way up to Kosygin, and he's got it hanging in his wall, in his office, I guess. He thought that was such a great thing.